Hi, my name is Max Pomyshev-Zamolov. I am the founder of Maximus Energy Corporation, and today I'm going to talk about ancient Egyptian pre-dynastic stone vessel. Objects in Medbel's collection cluster in two distinct clusters. One cluster was very consistent with modern objects, and the rest of his collection clustered in the same way the objects from the Petrie collection clustered. And that was a stunning revelation for me, too, because I realized that I can use this methodology, the metrological analysis that I developed, to, you know, apply to 3D scans and pass a judgment on how the object was made. And if we know how it was made, you know, we can tell when it was made.
Now, many of you have seen that video already, and in it, Max makes some pretty serious claims. He separated the vases into a few categories, basically ones that were made with more or less modern type of machinery and ones that were not. And according to him, when he tested the ones in the Cairo Museum, he found none of the ones that looked like they were made with modern machinery or precise measurements, and the ones that do show those kinds of things are all in private hands. Now, on the surface, this is pretty damning. If the vases in private hands are considerably different than those in the museums, the assumption that they are not from the same place isn't really crazy. So these vases that Matt Bell and Adam Young own, and Christopher Dunn and Ben Van Kirkwick have helped make famous, according to Max, most likely a hoax. All of them. And that's a pretty serious claim. Now, I do have to say that Max has wrote his own software, and he's brought some serious data to bear, and I do think that that's valuable, and I do tout him for that. But I personally feel that his conclusions are not nearly as definitive as he thinks they are, or the skeptics think they are. I think, honestly, that something rather obvious to a lot of people is being missed. There's a few things, but one in particular. So let's talk about it. Hi, my name is Dan, and welcome to Dunking. Well, for those of you who don't know, I'll just lay out really quickly what the deal is with these vases to begin with. The quick version is there are some vases from ancient Egypt made before the pyramids were built that are made of hard stone like granite, which show levels of precision in their manufacturing that seem too good for the technology the ancient Egyptians were said to have had. Now, some have claimed that this means the vases are evidence of ancient high technology, and as a result, a lot of these vases have ended up in private hands. In fact, according to Max, all of the ones that are really precise like that are in private hands, and they have sketchy provenance. The ones in the museum don't look so good, and they have better provenance. So again, according to Max, these are most likely hoaxes. Now, on the other hand, we have some vases in private hands that do have some pretty solid provenance, and there's a couple of vases in the museums that Carolee and Adam scanned that look to be extremely precise, up to snuff with some of the ones that are in private hands. Okay, now that's the basic lay of the land on the vases. Now, I've covered them in the past a couple of times, but you know, back then, there was only one team doing scans on them. Now we've got multiple teams. And so I felt back then like, you know, it's okay for somebody who's not doing scans to come and ask questions and kick the tires on this. But now, I mean, with all these guys, let them argue with each other about the numbers. I don't want to get into that side of it. I really just want to talk about the implications, the logic, and some of the things that are just being missed. But it isn't crazy to worry that an ancient Egyptian artifact may be a hoax. I mean, Egypt has been a source of fascination that has extended well beyond scientific curiosity for centuries. Centuries ago, Arab explorers dug their way into the Great Pyramid and also into the side of Menkaure's pyramid, looking for treasure. The Greeks and Romans were both fascinated with Egypt, and all the really cool stuff that happened in Egypt happened thousands of years before the Greeks and Romans were even on the scene. But the real interest in modern times happened when Napoleon invaded Egypt. He had a large expedition sent to many of the ancient sites that were known of back then, and this injected this cultural interest into something that before that had been more of an educated rich boy's hobby, an academic thing, and now all across the Western world, lots of people were very interested in ancient Egypt. And with them came the treasure hunters, the artifact collectors, the dealers, the looters. In short, your proto-archaeologists, your origins of the field of archaeology were to help categorize artifacts. Let's be very clear about that. Anyway, no matter how you slice it, the beginning of the field does owe much to the early days of Egyptian artifact looting, collecting and buying for totally fair prices. At any rate, it didn't take long for the poor people in Egypt to figure out that All of a sudden, this stuff that was not worth a whole lot had a huge market. There were artifacts that people already wanted before, but now anything in the sand that was associated with their ancestors could quite possibly be worth a fortune. And so they just, you know, they would go out and they would look in places that Grandpa told them there was a place to check out. They'd go dig up where they'd seen something when they were a kid. They'd go doing all of that, and then eventually there wasn't a whole lot of that left, and then, you know, just make some fakes. The counterfeiting industry in Egypt goes all the way back to Roman times, and there are a lot of artifacts that have been so heavily reproduced that if you go buy one, it's almost certainly going to be a fake. Scarabs are the first thing that come to mind. They have very distinct Egyptian features, but they're made out of cheap, readily available stone. They fit in your pocket, they're so small. So many of these have been faked over the years that Sir Flinders Petrie was buying hundreds a year when he first showed up in 1884, and he started limiting himself to about 30 a year that he thought were good ones after a couple of years because they were everywhere. And there were archaeological sites that were said to be teeming with them. In other words, these were literally everywhere in ancient Egypt. And for those who knew a lot about hieroglyphs, they could eliminate the more mundane forgeries based on their inscriptions. Now, beyond this, it can get very difficult to identify a forgery. The hoaxers will use artificial aging techniques, and this hides tool marks. They'll use period-appropriate inscriptions for the artifact they're hoaxing because they know what to do. So then, like, a collector comes along and they'll use microscopic analysis. Even then, the best they can do is look for iron or something that's out of place. Because basically, these guys are so good at what they do. And now the scientific community is basically, they kind of just given up on it, it seems. They don't really talk about it much at all anymore. The collecting community, however, they still discuss this quite a bit because they have a vested interest in it. Now, this is very telling when it comes to the state of ancient artifacts today. The collectors quite often are the ones to inform the interested public of the evidence of an artifact being a forgery. This is extremely common, and not just in Egyptology. When I did my video on the largest Clovis point in private hands, the Rutz Clovis, I found the academic websites weren't half as informative as the collector sites. And that makes sense. I mean, that was a big deal to show up in the market, and collectors are crazy. We tear pages out of magazines and put them on our wall. We're nuts. And we see that with Adam Young and Matt Bell and the vases. The collectors are the ones pushing to have this stuff scanned first. They're the ones that are really advancing our knowledge on these artifacts, just like archaeology came to be, like I told you a minute ago, from collectors wanting to categorize their shit. And we're getting a lot of really great data coming out of this. The problem, as I see it, is that a lot of this data is being interpreted incorrectly. Now, the difference in precision used by Max to differentiate between the manufacturing techniques is based on his software slicing the vases into rings and then calculating the accuracy of each of the rings. Measuring both concentricity, which is how circular it is, and centricity, which is what it sounds like, how well centered it was. A machinist would combine those two measurements and call it a runout, right? And this is basically how they determine wobble. Wobble is a common occurrence on older lathes or even a less experienced operator. On the flip side, a talented machinist can make some very precise parts with a mediocre lathe. But if the machinist really isn't too concerned with accuracy, he can get some less accurate results with a good lathe. Now, not only do we have that disparity, but we also have to take into account the number of crappy lathes the United States of America dumped into Southeast Asia in the form of economic aid after World War II. A lot of these have a lot of wobble, a lot of them are still in use today, and yeah, they look pretty shitty. So the lathe situation isn't exactly definitive by the measurements. You would have to actually kind of look for different kinds of wobble and different machines and stuff. It gets a lot more complicated than just saying good or bad measurement. But that stuff isn't nearly as important as my final point here, and that really comes down to something that's not that complicated when you really think about it. It's called selection bias. Now, selection bias is well known to most of you out there. I mean, if I ran a poll on my channel that said who sucks more at being a human, me or Flint Dibble, it's going to get a different result than if you ran that same poll at Flint's favorite fetish ball or whatever. You know, Dr. David Miano discussed these vases in the past, and he pointed out that, you know, selection bias is potentially an issue if you've got 20 vases on the shelf and you only measure the two that look really precise. You can't say that all the ones on the shelf are precise. You can only say that the two you cherry-picked are precise, and that's a fair point. Although it really doesn't have a lot to do with the precision of the vases that are scanned and are shown to be accurate. But selection bias is a factor in the vases, however, and that comes down to the manner Egyptian antiquities have been treated for the last few hundred years. And like I said earlier, the ancient Egyptian artifacts were all the rage at this point. They kind of still are today. A poor Egyptian, he found something, he would trade it to feed his family. A more affluent Egyptian might trade it for favor. At any rate, the artifacts were getting picked over. Before I go into a lot of detail on that, I'll give you an example, a parallel with something that I know a lot about and more of you'll be familiar with too, I think, old video games. The Nintendo 64 game Clay Fighter isn't really an expensive game, and it's really not too hard to find in a pawn shop or a thrift store or a yard sale. It sells for like 25 bucks. But there's another version. It was only released for Blockbuster, and it's one of the rarest games released in the United States for the system. They look almost the same, but the more expensive version has the subtitle Sculptor's Cut in very small print. It's the kind of thing most people are going to miss unless they know to look for it. And in order to know to look for it, you kind of have to know it exists, right? So let's take a hypothetical scenario. You walk into a pawn shop, there's 500 copies of Clay Fighter in a bin. If you start looking through them and you find a copy of Sculptor's Cut, you can safely assume you're the first person to look through that bin that knew what Sculptor's Cut was, right? And the second person will not find a copy of Sculptor's Cut. The third person will not. The early bird gets the worm and all that crap, right? Selection bias means that the good ones will be gone yesterday. And the fact of the matter is, it's easier and easier and easier to see this kind of thing happen with a collectible like this, that the difference is so subtle and so small that most people are going to miss it. And collectors and dealers alike hone in on things that offer consistent ways to find deals. I mean, when I started collecting older video games, they were cheap and plentiful. I mean, 50 cents a game was common, and I could buy entire collections of games with system, accessories, and all kinds of crap for $5. No one thought they were worth a crap until about 10 or 15 years ago. A few of us knew, but most people didn't. Back then, I had two copies of Sculptor's Cut go through my hands, and one of them came from a pawn shop, and they'd priced it at $3, which is what Clay Fighter was going for, the regular version. Their ignorance cost them money, and nowadays, if you go there, they're not so ignorant anymore, but they don't have any copies of Sculptor's Cut because the knowledge has caught up. But back then, they didn't have the knowledge, and guys like me and my friends that did, we made money on that crap. Now back to Egypt, and I bet you can see where I'm going here. The first person to posit that those vases may be the product of higher technology was Sir Flinders Petrie way back in the late 19th century, about 130 years ago. And as influential as Petrie is in the field of Egyptology, it stands to reason his observations were well known to those interested in Egyptian artifacts. So when other collectors or antiquity dealers, or sometimes Atlantis hunters even, for over 130 years, when they look at these vases, there's specific characteristics the savvy ones are looking for. There's a little title that says Sculptor's Cut on the side of the thing. Hard granite. Precise measurements. These things make them command a premium. Now imagine going to a high-end antiquity market in 1950s Egypt and seeing all manner of things for sale. Canoptic jars with their distinct faces, and sphinx statues, the aforementioned scarabs, trinkets with the shape of gods or pharaohs, and boats and scrolls, and then these little mundane-looking flower pots. Now, if you know that those flower pots have a version that is worth quite a bit to the collector, isn't that a great place to look at to try to make a dollar? Isn't that a great place to look at to try to find a way to go back to my parallel, buy a Nintendo game for 50 cents? Or if you saw 50 stone vases for sale, and only one of them is both a hard stone and precise looking, wouldn't that be the only one you'd be interested in? I mean, selection bias would have the savvy collectors and dealers finding these things quickly and then being sold to private individuals for big bucks. And if you think putting them in a museum made them immune to this, think again. Not to be rotten, but Egypt has had a problem with corruption for a long time, and these are the kinds of artifacts that they don't even look Egyptian, man, right? There's just this little pot. So it would be very easy to get rid of these, sell these. It's the kind of thing that most people wouldn't know was really cool. But again, to the people in the know, it's got the Sculptor's Cut written on it, right? So these were worth some money for a long time. You could even see them being sold to, like, you know, fix something that was better. You could see a museum actually selling it above the board, right? But the price on these things really took a huge jump when Ben Van Kirkwick started popularizing them a few years ago. Now, this dynamic's not limited to Nintendo games and vases. For those of you who tried to find a silver quarter nowadays, you know how selection bias is beating you up there. Same thing goes for if you're trying to find a good comic book in a box of comics or baseball cards. To flip the other way around, imagine if Willy Wonka's golden ticket was on the outside of the candy bar, or there was some way you could tell by looking at it. Then would any of those ended up in the hands of the public? Another way of looking at this, for those of you who are into the collectible card game stuff, early games with foils like Pokemon, they weighed the packs. People were weighing the packs in the 90s. I knew people weighing packs in the 90s when it was brand new. So you couldn't go to a gas station and buy a pack of Pokemon cards and get a Charizard. There were none there because without opening the packs, people had found ways to peel them out of there. This is a fact. And this is quite possibly what is happening with those vases. Now, sure, some of them could have been made in the 70s or the 60s or whatever to fit in each market. I'm sure that there are some fakes out there. I know some people are going to say we can't do it. Yes, we can make things out of granite today. Come on, guys. It might be expensive, and you're not going to be talking to a metal worker to figure that out. You need to talk to a guy who works with stone. But yeah, anyway, a lot of those things were probably in private hands before the increased restrictions on Egyptian artifacts being sold to private individuals. And if those vases were in museums and dealer warehouses, then it stands to reason they would all have been sold long ago. The collections picked over. Donations offered and accepted for the preservation of better antiquities, potentially. Personal gain. Basically the same thing as sculptor's cut. If you show up at the yard sale at noon expecting to find it, you're not going to see one. Doesn't mean there was never one there. Now, there are lots of hoaxes in the Egyptian antiquity market. And like I said, the scarabs were at the forefront as far as like the most commonly reproduced and most often talked about. But there are lots of very famous hoaxes that have been in museums and stuff. And right now, we have some very interested amateurs hammering away at this, asking, is this a hoax?
There's been ample speculation about the precision of ancient Egyptian stone vessels on the internet. Countless videos on YouTube, lots of discussion on online and offline. And I found all of this fascinating and interesting, and it motivated me to begin the research into ancient Egyptian stone vessels.
So even though I disagree with Max's conclusions, I praise his data, I praise him bringing these things up, and I'm happy to see this debate. As long as it's not vitriolic, as long as we're discussing things here, the Egyptian antiquities market in 50 years will probably be looking back on this very moment going, damn, these guys really laid some serious groundwork for us. So I guess that would take us full circle right back to the origins of archaeology itself, wouldn't it? Anyway, thank you very much for watching. I'm going to be in Sedona, Arizona, May 1st through 3rd. There's going to be other people there cooler than me, if there is such a thing. There's a link down below. There's also links to support the channel. Thank you very, very much to my Patreon supporters, the channel members, those of you who watch the ads, likes and subscribes, even the people that tell me the mean things. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.